Excellence Program. Together, the NCAA and Daedalus have enlisted hundreds of individual teams from lots of sports and universities and colleges throughout the United States. And as you've seen lately, a lot of headlines are drawing attention to the importance of surveilling and doing some concussion research. We've had concussion with Will Smith that came out earlier this year. And as you guys have seen, lots of studies and research, a lot of what Daedalus has done that's pointing to the importance of training coaches in youth sports and in youth football to reduce the occurrence of concussions. And then also on the flip side, you've got NFL and pros that are having some issues on the concussion side as well. So a lot of states and universities and the NCAA are implementing programs and policies to help prevent and treat traumatic brain injury. And Indiana's leading the national change on all of this. I mean, it's very exciting through the work of Daedalus. They have been collecting sports injury and treatment data that's been instrumental in the development of more effective programs, policies, rules, and education aimed at preventing, mitigating, and treating sports injuries more effectively. So today, we're going to hear from some of the nation's experts who just happen to be, you know, right here in the middle of Indianapolis, which is fantastic. We're going to hear from Dr. Tom Dampier, who has been with Daedalus since June 2011, and he serves as the president and lead epidemiologist. His experience as an athletic trainer for both collegiate and professional sports teams, along with graduate experience as the director of the Graduate Athletic Training Education Program at the University of South Carolina, provides a solid foundation for leadership for not only Daedalus Center, but its partners as well. So Tom's going to come and enlighten us on some things, and then we'll go to a panel with some additional experts. So thank you, Tom.
Great. Thank you, Lori. Thanks for those kind words and the nice introduction. Well, thank you, everybody, for joining us today. It's really exciting to be here speaking before you all. As Lori said, I've been here since 2011, but I'm a Midwest guy. I grew up in Michigan, went to school at Michigan State, and then Penn State, and back again to Michigan State before starting my professional career. As Lori mentioned, I started out my career as an athletic trainer working in sports, primarily football and ice hockey, which have some of the highest rates of injury, including concussion, as you can imagine, by the nature of the sport. So I used to be one of those people that you'd see run onto the field and actually help the athletes when they got hurt. So I worked with the Jacksonville Jaguars, worked here in Indianapolis with the Colts as an intern while I was doing my studies. Won a national championship with Penn State. My name's forever engraved on the Murdoch Cup. But an athletic trainer is a healthcare professional that specializes in sport, but they're primarily dealing with secondary and tertiary prevention, meaning that we help the athletes after they've already been hurt. We do some things like taping and bracing to try to prevent some injuries, but I was a little frustrated working as a clinician because I wanted to focus more on the primary prevention aspect of sport and try to prevent the injuries before they actually happen. So that's what was the impetus for me to go back and get my PhD in injury epidemiology, where I studied with Dr. John Powell at Michigan State, and Dr. John Powell ran the Big Ten's and the NFL's injury surveillance programs for about 30 years before he recently retired. So one of the conundrums we always run into in injury epidemiology or public health in general is how do you demonstrate prevention? If an intervention is so effective that it prevents the occurrence from happening, how do you statistically demonstrate that you actually made a difference? And so in all my studies in public health and epidemiology, we none of my textbooks, none of my professors knew the answer to that question. So I had to turn to the logic literature to find an answer to how we demonstrate prevention. And really, as long as you have trained observers, and what we rely upon in our research is athletic trainers as the trained observers on the ground documenting concussions, documenting injuries, we have somebody in place that who should be able to observe these occurrences when they happen. So based on Kopy's logic, you know, if we don't see the occurrences happening while we have the athletic trainers on the ground, then we can say we've prevented an injury, even if we can't statistically say definitively that we've done that. So we kind of rely on that with some of our stuff we're doing, particularly for USA Football, where their heads-up coaching education program has been so effective, even though we've had an adequate sample size, the intervention so effective that we can't statistically demonstrate an actual reduction just because there's so few concussions that are occurring. So the Dateless Center, as Lori mentioned, was formed by BioCrossroads, the NCAA, and ACSM. And I'm not exactly sure Troy's here in the audience. He was my predecessor and the project manager at BioCrossroads who built the company and kept it afloat until I got here in 2011. So he may know the answer to this more than I do, but I think the impetus for the NCAA exporting the injury surveillance program, which had been ongoing at the NCAA internally since 1982 or so, was to have an independent group do it, removing it from within the NCAA itself, and then also have the ability to not only manage the injury surveillance program, but part of our service agreement with the NCAA is to then actually disseminate it, to publish the data, to get it out into the public purview where people can use it and learn from it. So we are a 501c3 nonprofit. We started out as a 509a2, which means we were kind of self-supporting but relying on grants and other things to support ourselves. But as it turns out, we are mostly getting most of our revenue from service agreements and that sort of thing. So we had to change our tax classification, sub-classification, but we're still a 501c3, but now a 509a3, which means we had to become a supporting other organization of other nonprofits that have similar missions. And so we looked at BioCrossroads, we looked at the NCAA, and for various reasons, whether it be tax status with those companies or mission fit, we decided to go with the AOSSM, which is the American Orthopedic Society of Sports Medicine, and the American College of Sports Medicine are now our supported partners by Dateless. And our mission is very consistent with theirs as well. And so what our mission is to basically collaborate with other organizations, and that's a key part of our mission, is collaboration. And so we collaborate with others to help policymakers like the NCAA, USA Football, make sports safer. That's our core mission. And so our vision is to promote health and physical activity through safer sports. One of the things with Dateless, because we generally talk about the negative aspect of sports, which is injury, and we sometimes get accused of trying to, get rid of sport, and that's not the case at all. We want to make it safer so that we don't have to get rid of sport, because there's a lot of talk right now about banning football and banning tackling and all these other things. So if we can make the game safer, that'll alleviate some of those pressures to get rid of it. So that's our goal. So we have a strong foundation in terms of our board leadership. I've been very thankful and very lucky to have a very engaged and mentoring board. Troy Hagee, again, I keep invoking his name as he's here, but has been a great friend and mentor to me. As I mentioned, he was my predecessor running the company for 5 years or so before I got here, and then he served on our board of directors before recently stepping off as well. But again, great leadership, and then we've had a strong faculty and staff as well. So when I got here, there was just myself and then two staff members to support me. We only had the NCAA Injury Surveillance Program as our only project at the time. And since then, we've added five new staff and a couple new PhDs, and we also have an external advisory board who helps us review grant applications and also applications for data that we provide out. So this is just it's hard to see, I'm sorry, but it's a long list. These are our collaborators who have either helped us with publications, have collaborated on grants, or helped us in some way with one of our research projects. And so we have, again, from our mission statement, one of our key aspects of that is to collaborate with others. And so I think we've done a pretty good job of meeting that goal. And this doesn't even include the hundreds of colleges and universities and the hundreds of high schools around the nation that contribute data to our injury surveillance programs. So it's really a nice list of collaborators, but again, it doesn't encompass everybody who should be thanked, really. So what does the Dateless Center do? What services do we provide? We're basically similar to like a contract research organization that you might see working in pharma or something like that, except our specialty is sports, and our bread and butter projects are injury surveillance, as you can see up there. So we're good at doing multi-center, multi-year data collection efforts centered around sports. But we also do survey studies. We do qualitative research. We do intervention studies and different things like that as well for some of our sponsors. So we're kind of a multifaceted group, but all of us have experience as either athletes or athletic trainers within our company. And that's one of the things I've tried to promote when hiring new people, is that they have some experience in the sports market so they understand what they're looking at. So the purpose of surveillance, again, I said that's kind of our bread and butter, and it's basically to inform, right? So surveillance gives you the who, what, when, where of who gets injured. It's not ideally suited for doing in-depth etiological studies where we might be looking at risk factors or interventions, but it can provide a foundation for doing those types of studies. And so from the data that we collect in the injury surveillance programs that we manage at the NCAA and then also at the high school level and at the youth level, we're able to create peer-reviewed manuscripts, fact sheets, and other forms of dissemination that we provide out. So this is our active list of programs that we have at the Daedalus Center right now that are ongoing. The top three are the ones we're going to talk about a little bit more today with our collaborators that are here to join us. And they're also all centered here in Indiana, which I think is important. As Lori mentioned, Indiana really is the center for sports-centered life sciences work, and it's a great honor to be involved in that. So surveillance is basically the first step in prevention. And from surveillance, we can either do sub-studies related to etiology to look at risk factors, or we can just do an individual study related to that. And then from that, you can do interventions, and then you go back around and do surveillance to see if the intervention worked. I also listed the various programs that we're currently managing and where they kind of fall into that paradigm. And you can kind of see that USA Football's Heads Up program and Project CARE are centered around the risk factors, and then also for interventions as well. And I'll talk a little bit more about each one in depth. So our sponsors use the program or data from our programs quite often. The NCAA uses it to inform their membership about injuries. That's some of the data that gets included in the sports medicine handbook. On average, we provide the NCAA about 48 confidential data-driven deliverables each year. And then if you count all the publications, which we average about 8 per year, and all the other types of meetings and presentations that we go to, we provide the NCAA about 90 or so deliverables per year based on the injury surveillance program alone. And then for USA Football, we also provide several deliverables, whether it be presentations, reports, publications, and different things. And then at the high school level, we also publish and do all that and that sort of thing as well. Project CARE is just kind of getting up and running, and that's going to also start producing a lot of interesting data because, as I mentioned, that's getting more into the risk factors, which is really neat. And I'll talk a little bit more about that. So I did want to mention that, as I said, the cool thing about our sponsors, and this is as part of our mission, we want to disseminate the information that we collect. And so our partners have been great about letting us share this information with the community, not just Indiana, but the entire world, really. We've published in the CDC's MMWR and also some top-tier journals like JAMA Pediatrics and others. So our Indiana-based partners are allowing us to inform the world, basically. So the NCAA Injury Surveillance Program, as I mentioned a little bit earlier, actually started back in 1974 as a small project at Penn State. And some interesting history here, because I started, I did my master's at Penn State. My mentor, John Powell, was a graduate student at Penn State when the NARES project, which was the National Athletic Injury Reporting System, began. And so that's where he learned how to do injury surveillance. And so he, you know, then carried on beyond that. The NCAA in 1982 went from Penn State to the NCAA, which was in Kansas City at the time. And they managed the injury surveillance program from 1982 to 2009 when the Daedalus Center took over. But again, remember, Daedalus got incorporated in about 2006. So Daedalus was doing some work for the NCAA from 2007 to 2009, some small analyses and reports. but then formally took over the injury surveillance program in 2009. The interesting thing about that is that it's probably one of the longest running injury surveillance programs consistently. Well, it really is. And the NFL started in the 1980s as well. The Big Ten started in the 1980s. But the NCAA's program is the longest running. And it really is like a public health program, right? So the NCAA uses the data to inform their rules committees, their sports governing committees, and all kinds of different committees and decisions are made based on these data. So it's important for us to give them a good product in terms of what the data can tell them. So the Project CARE Consortium, which Dr. McAllister is the lead PI on as well, is a huge project. It's going to be considered the Framingham study of concussion research, and I'll let him talk a little bit more about that later. But to date, that study has enrolled over 15,000 student athletes. I think it's up to 17,000 now, and then over 700 concussions have been captured. And the idea then is to enroll all these student athletes, and they're not just football players. That's an important note. They're not just football players. They're also golfers and tennis players and other athletes who aren't banging their head all the time, which is very important because we don't have a lot of data on those types of athletes. So we're going to follow those athletes for hopefully 30, 35 years or so and see if playing sports, whether it be football, tennis, or whatever, causes any impairments to your cognitive abilities or other things, or what risk factors actually lead to those sorts of things. You know, because right now, that if you believe the media, if just playing sport alone causes these things, and we think there's probably other mitigating factors. So it's looking at all kinds of neat things like biomarkers and imaging and all kinds of cool stuff. So very happy to be part of that project. Now, the cool thing about the USA Football Project, the Heads Up coaching education program, it's really an intervention designed to make youth football safer. This is exciting research because it actually shows we can prevent something. And so these two publications, which came out last year, really demonstrate that you can not only reduce injuries and concussions, but you can reduce impacts to the head. And if you've heard the media lately, there's a lot of concern about even impacts to the head that don't cause concussion might cause CTE or this chronic traumatic encephalopathy. But what we, and whether it does or not, you know, it seems prudent to reduce the number of impacts to the head, right? Because, you know, it's probably not good to bang your head all the time. And so that research has actually shown that you can reduce impacts to the head. And I just want to show a little bit of that research because I think this is really important. So these are the injury rates. So an injury rate is simply the number, if you had 1,000 people on the field at the same time, this is how many injuries you might expect. So the graph on the left is all injuries, and the one on the right is time loss injuries or more severe injuries. And you can see that the bar on the far left, which is the Heads Up education program plus some policy changes, results in the greatest benefit or the greatest reduction in injury rates. And then if you just educate the coaches through the Heads Up certification program, you still see a benefit, not as great as including the policy change, but still shows a benefit, which is great. And so this research has been very well received. I just got back from Chicago, where I gave a talk about this very research as well. And, you know, the great thing about it is it's actually making a change within the communities. It's actually being used by communities to make youth football safer, which is important. It also reduced head impact exposure. So the bar on the right were youth football players who were not in the Heads Up certified teams. And then the bar on the left is the teams where there was Heads Up certified coaches. So on average, we prevented about 3 impacts above 10 G per practice. Now, I don't know if 10 G is an important number or not. Jumping off 2 stairs is about 8 G when you land on the floor. If you ride on a roller coaster, that's about 5 G or so. So is 10 G important? I don't know, but that's the number we use as the threshold. And we also looked at above 20 G, and that prevented about 1 impact above 20 G per practice. And then there were too few impacts above 50 G to do any statistical analysis about that. But we did have some youth football players receive 120 G impacts, and that's about as high as professional and college athletes have also been shown to receive. So that was a little scary, but The good news is heads up football prevents some of those. We also just finished a study here in Indiana. I wanted to point that one out because it was done here in Indiana. Indiana is kind of unique within the football world because the coaches are required to go through all components of heads-up football, but they're not required to have a player safety coach. And a player safety coach is a member of the coaching staff who goes around and makes sure the other coaches are implementing the paradigm of heads-up football. And so we wanted to see if the player safety coach actually had a benefit because USA Football was wondering, should we continue to promote the player safety coach? And so this gave us an opportunity to do that. And you can see that with the player safety coach there, it added the benefit such that we lowered the all-injury rate by 38%, 43% for the more severe injuries, and then 88% lower concussions. So huge impact in terms of prevention and safety for youth football. So one of the things I wanted to, I'm getting close on time here, but I want to just kind of point this out a little bit. So why is football the, and I, pardon the pun, but why is football the punching bag for talking about concussion and CTE? Is it because it's actually more dangerous, or is it because we just see more concussions because more concussions occur on a team, not because the rate is actually higher, but simply because the teams are larger and there's much more generation of concussions? When we account for the team size, the squad size, number of games, practices, and that sort of thing, you can see there's other sports that actually have a higher rate of injury than football. So, you know, football's kind of erroneously been pegged as the demon sport, but there are other sports that need to worry about this issue as well. So I think Project CARE specifically is really neat because it's going to start to get at some of that. And I think that's an important study that's going to really shed light. And again, this is the risk. So again, football even falls farther down on the list when you look at risk, which is the percent of athletes who might suffer one concussion during the season. So looking toward the future, I think Project CARE is the future. It really is the study that's going to help inform the world about what happens when you play sports over the course of your life. It's going to look at both the positive and the benefits of playing sports. So it's not all just about the negative. And then what we're hoping to do is make sports safer from all injuries, not just concussions. I know concussions the elephant in the room all the time, but we got to think about, particularly at the youth level, specialization and overuse, because you're seeing kids going to the ER with spiral fractures of the forearm from throwing too much. You're seeing the tendonitises and other things. So I think we really need to start thinking about, you know, what does youth sport look like? And I know that's one of Dr. Hainline's goals with the NCAA is to look at the athlete over the lifespan, not just as the NCAA athlete. So he'll talk more about that, I'm sure. And then, you know, we want to promote sports participation because sports have so many positive benefits. We don't want to just talk about the negative all the time. And then we're also doing some additional work for USA Football looking at their new development model, which will give athletes options instead of just playing tackle. Maybe you play flag or modified or 7-on-7 or different things. So USA Football has really been proactive about finding ways to improve the game, make it safer, make it more fun for kids. And again, all this is going on right here in Indiana, which I think is great. So I'm happy to be a part of it. I do want to thank BioCrossroads, the NCAA, and ACSM for founding us. Again, special shout-out to Troy for being my friend and mentor and actually recruiting me for this position here at Daedalus. It's been great. And all the staff and at BioCrossroads have been very helpful for us over the years as well. And then all of our Indiana-based partners. And the athletic trainers who collect the data. I can't not thank them. So I'm going to introduce our panel now. Dr. Brian Hainline from the NCAA. Brian's first. So Dr. Hainline, I guess we all come up to the seats now, I guess is how we're doing this. So again, we've been working with the NCAA since going back to 2006. Dr. Hainline will tell you more about himself in terms of when he joined the NCAA and what his goals are. It's interesting to note that in the 100-year history of the NCAA, he's the first chief medical officer, and he's only been there for about 3 years. And the whole reason the NCAA was created was to prevent injuries in college sports when football was almost abolished by Teddy Roosevelt. So he'll tell you more about that, I'm sure. And Dr. McAllister is a professor at Indiana University's School of Medicine, and he's the PI on Project CARE, which we help out with. And Steve Alec is the Senior Director of Communications with USA Football, who's our primary point of contact for all of our research we do with USA Football. So, Dr. Heinlein, if you want to say a few words.
Well, thanks, Tom, and good morning, everyone. So I have roots here in Indiana as well, even though our home is still in New York. I did go to school at Notre Dame, where I was a student athlete, and I still compete in that great sport of tennis. And coming to the NCAA, I had to learn about a few other sports. So it was kind of interesting when I came to the NCAA because they knew I was from New York and that I was very interested in tennis. So the contract was very particular. One is I had to divest myself from a lot of the tennis activities and invest in the 22 other sports. And then there were two kind of curious clauses. One is that I had to have Indiana residence within a year of taking the job. And that was kind of tough because I was traveling all over, really didn't have time to look for a place, and my wife and I still kept our home in New York. But I did arrive with my driver's license at the one-year date, and it had Indiana residence, and it was 120 West Market Street, which is the address of the Hilton. And then I remember sometimes guests would come in. I remember General Corelli, the former vice chief of staff of the Army, and you know, he was staying at the Hilton. I met him there, and we had dinner next door. But it was sort of one of those flashback moments of the Graduate movie, because, you know, I would walk in and everyone would say, "Oh, good evening, Dr. Heinlein," and "Good hello, Dr. Heinlein." And General Corelli was kind of like scratching his head and thinking of Dustin Hoffman way back when. But the other part of the clause in my contract was called the Good Neighbor Clause. And that was that the NCAA, being in Indianapolis, it's very important for us to really be part of the community. And so that's something that I really have embraced, and we have had several functions at the NCAA that are really community-based. But importantly, you know, the two things that have been really most important for me, one is actually I'm part of Indiana University School of Medicine, and I do oversee a neurology clinic there twice a month. And we collaborate with IU, and I'm going to talk about that in a little bit. And then the other part is our work with Dataless, which has been exceptionally important, and I'm going to talk about that. And our work with USA Football, and I've gone to many of their meetings, and I think what they are really doing and the data Tom pointed to is really rather exceptional. Within the NCAA, and we have three of our members back here, John Parsons, Mary Wilford, Cassie Folk. We have created a Sports Science Institute, and our mission there is to promote and develop safety, excellence, and wellness in college student athletes, and to foster lifelong physical and mental development. And when we analyze those statements, we don't separate excellence from safety and wellness. We know that if a student athlete is to excel, it must be done from a place of safety and wellness. And we also don't separate physical and mental. And too often we do, or we ignore the mental or emotional aspects of a student athlete. But really, on this great planet of ours, every perception, every experience is physical. And there is a bidirectionality that's always taking place. And so that's something that we really have incorporated into our day-to-day practice. When I interviewed for the job at the NCAA, I said, you know, I really don't see that there's any problem with the NCAA other than that we're part of society. And so we really have to place the NCAA and sport in a societal perspective. And within that perspective, there are some very important issues we need to confront. And you know, this great country of ours, the United States of America, we are now officially one of the most physically illiterate countries in the developed world. And physical illiteracy carries with it exceptional risks, not only from an economic point of view. Our health system is going to be bankrupt in 30 years if we continue on the same trajectory. from a national defense point of view, 50% of the military servicemen and women who want to serve are unable to do so because they're too physically illiterate. And just from a basic academic point of view, we know that kids who are physically illiterate perform less well academically, and their brain development is impaired as a result of physical illiteracy. So this is a huge issue. And one of the things that can help really save society, if you will, and this is a serious societal issue, is sport. But sport must be done right. And as Tom mentioned, the NCAA has taken a great interest in youth sport. Now, we have no ability to sanction youth sport. We are the national governing body of 1,100 schools that participate in college varsity athletic sports. But one of the most important things we've done is we've connected with youth sport. So one of the things we do is we have these sport-specific summits. And when we do them in conjunction with the national governing body leadership of sport. We do it with the youth sport leadership. And we make certain that we have coaches along the entire continuum. And we're going to be doing this sport by sport. It's an 8 to 10 year project. But ultimately, we have to understand that youth sport, and Tom mentioned the American development model with USA Hockey. The American development model, for those of you who don't know, all 48 national governing bodies in this country are signatories to the American development model. The American development model, which was started by USA Hockey, states that kids before the age of puberty, the most important foundation in sport is fundamentals. And fun is with a capital F, capital U, capital N. If we don't have fun when we play sport, the chance of us dropping out is exceptionally high, and there's a 75% dropout of organized sport at the age of puberty. And then the American development model talks about a logical progression, which ultimately leads to specialization. But if you're specializing before the age of puberty, you're setting yourself up to drop out of sport, to get burnt out, and to basically not become a great athlete. All we need to do is to look at ESPN Little League World Series and track the last 40 years and ask yourself how many of those 12-year-old boys with beards ever pitched in Major League Baseball. And none of them have. They specialize early and they burn out. So that's a very important part of our mission. But then getting to really the crux of today, concussion is an exceptionally important public health issue. But we don't single out concussion. We believe that concussion is a public health issue, as are several other very, very important issues. Mental health, cardiac care, overuse injuries, doping, sexual assault, nutrition and sleep, and then how we administer athletics health care and how we make data-driven decisions. All of these are extremely important, and that's why our partnership with Dataless is so key, because Dataless is helping us track on all of those public health initiatives in sport. And the only way we're going to change society is we have to make data-driven decisions. If we took Tom's the proof that he quoted up there, that the absence of proof can then be compelling evidence of proof that something didn't occur, well, if we don't have all of the NCAA schools centrally linked to Dataless, one could argue that a number of injuries are never occurring, because we don't have proof that they occurred. We need not only the proof that they occurred, we need to analyze them and go forward. And that's the exceptional work we are doing with Dataless. With USA Football, we are partners with them all of the way. The studies that Tom quoted, I mean, it's really exceptional. And it just hasn't gotten the press that it deserves. If we do things right, we actually make a difference, and that's what USA Football has demonstrated. And so that's really critical. And then finally, my partnership with Indiana University, and especially Tom McAllister, what Tom and the two other principal investigators have done in this concussion study is beyond exceptional, and it's exceeded everyone's expectations. So Tom is working with Steve Broglio from University of Michigan and Mike McRae from Medical College of Wisconsin, and they have put together a study that everyone acknowledges, every serious scientist who has looked at this has acknowledged, this is the seminal study in concussion. And already, after just 1 year, now we're at 1.5 years, over 17,000 student athletes have been studied, over 700 concussions, over 25 million data points, and they're analyzing it as we speak. And there's some really amazing data coming out. I'll just give you one piece. Kids who don't report concussion early for one reason or another, they have a longer return to play trajectory. It's no different than if you injure your knee, you have an ACL injury, and you don't report it right away and get treatment right away, you're going to injure it more. So we have some compelling data coming out of CARE. And this, so all of these relationships, Dataless, USA Football, Indiana University, the CARE study, all of this is really shaping sport from a public health model. And in my heart of hearts, I really buy into completely what Nelson Mandela said so eloquently, that sport can save society. And if we are to save society, and I truly believe sport can be one of the saviors of society, then we need partners like IU and USA Football and Dataless. And on behalf of the NCAA, I can tell you that we really feel privileged to have these partners. So thanks for being here today and listening.
Our next speaker is Dr. McAllister. Dr. McAllister, again, is a faculty at Indiana University School of Medicine in the Department of Psychiatry. And, again, he's, Dr. Hainline mentioned, one of the primary investigators on Project CARE, which we're partnered with and very excited to be so. So, Dr. McAllister.
Thanks, Tom, and thank you all for being here as well. Just wanted to tell you a little bit about the CARE project, and but to do that, I have to step back a little bit and just say that I've been working in brain injury rehabilitation recovery for probably about 30 years, and probably if we had this event, 20 years ago, there would be no one in the room because people really didn't appreciate the concern about brain injury and mild brain injury in particular. And for most of us, the term mild brain injury and concussion can be used synonymously. So I may slip back and forth between those terms. But essentially what happened about probably in the late 80s was that a guy named Jeff Barth at the University of Virginia, Mr. Jefferson's University, he called it, decided that if we wanted to learn about mild brain injury, what a great model if we studied athletes, particularly football players, because we know that they're at risk for having a mild brain injury, a concussion, and we can study them before the season starts, and then if they're identified as having an injury, we can study them again. And the reason that was important is that at that point in time in the 1980s-ish, we really didn't know whether what people reported, athletes reported, or other folks with brain injury reported in terms of cognitive problems, personality change, depression, and so forth and so on after a mild brain injury. We didn't know whether that was just them reporting these things or whether it was actually part and parcel of a brain injury. So the whole concept of leveraging student athletes who were at risk so that we could get some baseline studies beforehand and then follow them up afterwards was really a novel idea back then. And so there were some initial studies that were done, and lo and behold, it appeared as though concussion did result in some cognitive difficulties and some personality changes and so forth. And the perception was that that said, pretty much everybody got better and got better quickly. So that was the 90s. And then shortly after the turn of the century, Mike McRae, who's a fantastic partner in this CARE consortium and one of the pioneers in sport-related concussion, along with Kevin Guskowitz, another gentleman who's involved in the CARE project, working with the NCAA, instituted the NCAA concussion study, one of the first ones. I guess it was the first one. With NCAA support. And that was predominantly football players that had a sample size of somewhere around, I want to say about 200, I think, folks with concussion. And again, the take-home message from that was lots of people get concussion. They have trouble with cognitive complaints, memory, attention, concentration, and so forth. They have a little bit of trouble with balance and disequilibrium, and they have they report a variety of symptoms, headache, irritability, sleep problems, et cetera, et cetera. But if you looked at the recovery graphs and curves, it turned out that most everybody got better within about 10 days. Now, these were elite athletes at NCAA schools, typically very healthy. Sadly, folks generalized from that that the whole world should get better after a concussion and that anybody who didn't was just making things up or really just didn't want to play or whatever. Not everybody said that, but that was one of the underlying themes. And then all of a sudden, what happened? What happened was the conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan, in which exposure to multiple concussive blast situations in our military personnel became, it was labeled the signature wound of that war. And all of a sudden, an enormous amount of publicity attended mild brain injury. People began to focus on it. I just couldn't believe it. It was like, seriously? People are interested in mild brain injury all of a sudden? And they were interested to the point of, you know, investing large sums of money to fund research for it. And it was in that context that, and then, of course, there was the concern about NFL players. So it was, again, after the turn of the century, probably about 2002, 2003, when the first report of former NFL players having this thing called chronic traumatic encephalopathy was written up in the scientific literature. So there was this confluence of societal concerns. You had this massive cohort of military personnel who were returning from Iraq and Afghanistan and reporting it was about 20% who had been exposed to a mild brain injury or multiple mild brain injuries. And then you had the interest focused on the NFL players. And I think the part of the narrative that Brian didn't mention in his talk, but which he played a pivotal role, is that he and some members of the Department of Defense came together and said, you know what, we both have an issue here. Concussion is affecting athletes. We don't really understand it. And concussion is affecting military personnel. And as it turns out, there are a lot of similarities, typically young, typically healthy, very athletic. Maybe what we ought to do is pool resources and try and fund a study that would help inform our knowledge about concussion and recovery from concussion. And that was in about 2013. So Brian and a gentleman named Colonel Hack convened a group of concussion folks interested in this area and said, let's get together and sort of figure out what we know, what we don't know. If we're going to invest some money, where should it go? And within about a year or so, there was a partnership formed between the Department of Defense and the NCAA called the Grand Alliance, and a decision was made to fund a large study of concussion and recovery from concussion, a natural history. And that's what ended up being the CARE project. And so that stands for Concussion Assessment, Research, and Education. We had to come up with something, right? What can I say? So that's the CARE Consortium. And the idea was what's really important is to figure out what happens when somebody has a concussion, how long do symptoms last, and when an athlete reports, yes, I'm good to go, put me back in, coach, does that necessarily mean that the brain is ready to go back in? So is there a difference between somebody saying, I'm all good, put me in, and the brain saying, not so much. You know, I still need a little bit of recovery time. So fast forward, we worked with folks to put together a study which would do exactly that. So we would study a large number of athletes preseason. When they were identified as having a concussion, then we would study them at five time points subsequent to that, including up to 6 months afterwards. And we would have, at the end of the day, a very large data set that could inform policy, we hoped. And also, very importantly, a subgroup of those athletes were going to go under the microscope. They were going to wear helmets that were equipped with sensors so we could count and quantify, as Tom was talking about earlier, how hard and how often are they getting hit over the course of a season, and does that matter? And we were going to image them with multimodal MRI imaging, so state-of-the-art sort of very, very sophisticated looks at the brain white matter, the brain gray matter, changes in brain volume, et cetera, et cetera. And we decided to search for the Holy Grail, which in this case is some kind of fluid biomarker, some sort of lab test that you could draw blood in somebody that you were worried about, and it would come back, and you would say, yes, had a concussion, or no, good to go. And so the way to do that is draw blood from everybody, again, preseason, and then after concussion, and 5 or 6 time points after that. And then finally, there was a there's a lot of evidence which suggests that okay, most of us would probably opt out of hitting your head 500 or 600 times over the course of 3 or 4 months really hard. But for those who don't and want to engage in contact sports, you know, is it the case that everybody is equally vulnerable to these long-term effects of concussion, or might it be the case that you know, this side of the room has a particular gene which, when you hit your head, the brain doesn't handle it very well. And this side of the room has a different copy of that gene which says, I'm good to go. You can hit me as hard as you want, for as often as you want, and I'll probably be okay. So taking a look at the genetics of underlying brain injury and recovery from brain injury. So that, in essence, became the CARE project. And basically, as Brian and Tom mentioned, we're at a point now where, thanks to Steve Broglio at Michigan, who has just been done a heroic job with his team, that we have enlisted now 30 schools across the country, 9 of which are coming online in the next several months, so they're not quite contributing data yet. 4 of the military academies are engaged in this because obviously it would be important for the Department of Defense to get a military-relevant population. We have enrolled, so Steve and his team in particular have enrolled some 17,000 athletes who have undergone baseline testing in cognition, in symptom reporting, in balance, in I'm looking at Jody, who does most of the work here at IU for us to see what else we're. But those, so across a variety of domains. And then we have been able to then study, identify 700, between 700 and 800 athletes who have had a concussion. And we're now getting data back from them being followed up at 5 subsequent time points so that we're going to get a nice history or a nice data set of the natural history of recovery from concussion. Then Mike McRae at Medical College of Wisconsin is doing the more under the microscope kind of thing with the brain imaging and the biomarkers and the genetics and the head, the helmet sensors and so forth. So stop and think about this for a second. So 17,000 enrolled. We're probably going to be up to about 25 or 30,000 in the next year or two. We're looking now at probably having 1,200 concussions. We have we give questionnaires. We do tests of this and that. That's a lot of data. We needed somebody to just organize this. And so when we were working with Brian about who was going to, how this consortium was going to be set up, and what, you know, I walked into the dean for research at that point in time and said, look, I think this is a really good thing to do, but, you know, we need a team assembled here. This is a huge effort. And it was really the partnership with Daedalus connected through our biostats team and also through Brian, who knew them from NCAA, that said, oh, yep, we do that. You know, sort of like that Staples ad. Yep, we got that. We can do it. And so we have, as Brian mentioned, or Tom mentioned, I think, some 25 million data points already. And if you can imagine what has to happen for this to be functional, it's great to collect the data, but if you can't make use of the data and organize the data and make sure that it's good data, it's a complete waste of time and money. So having Tom and his team have been it's been a key to the success, really. And he helped connect us with another company that he works with called Question, so that we athletes can now be sitting at their field or their locker room and input data after a concussion or at preseason directly into an online portal. And then the biostats team and Tom's team work to sort of organize the data so that it can be analyzed, and then it's fed forward to things like the NCAA and how they think about rule changes and so forth and so on. So within 18 months, I think we're really, I'm looking at Brian for this, but we're at a point where some of the data is actually being used now to at least inform some of organizations who are associated with sports safety, and to help organize what should be position statements from various professional organizations on, you know, this is the right way to do things, and this is not the right way to do things, and so forth. So I think the point I wanted to make was a really exciting study. I'm just delighted to be a part of it. Couldn't do it without Jody and our team at IU, and certainly the connection with the NCAA and the connection with Tom and the Dataless team have been just you know, foundational to our being able to do that. And what we're hoping is that it's only the beginning. So the believe it or not, this is all supposed to happen within 3 years, and we're now 18 months into it. So, but that's a question for another time, I think. What we would love to do is be able to say, okay, maybe what we need to do is try and figure out what happens to folks long term. So 6 months is great. It's longer than anybody else has looked at concussion, but really now what people are concerned about is concussion the right metric, or is it how many times you hit your head and how hard you hit it, and what happens 10 years from now, 20 years from now, 30 years from now? And nobody knows. We know that some people are vulnerable to it, but we don't know what the percentage is, and we don't know what the mechanism is. So those are really pivotal unknown questions that need to be answered. Thanks.
All right. Our next panelist is Steve Alec. Again, he's the Senior Director of Communications with USA Football, and he's our primary point of contact for our injury surveillance programs that we've been managing for USA Football since 2012, going over 4 years now. Just finished up our fourth season of data collection. And USA Football has really been a leader in the youth sport area in terms of trying to find ways to prevent injuries. Again, football has been kind of the punching bag for all of sports. USA Hockey and US Lacrosse are kind of keeping their heads down, hoping, you know, nobody notices what's going on within those sports. But USA Football, of all those groups, have been more proactive in trying to address the issue of not only concussion but all injuries. So, Steve?
Thank you very much, Tom. First off, thanks to Frameworks for reaching out and engaging with USA Football. Really humbled to be sitting up here with these folks, and appreciate the partnership with Dataless NCAA, and also Coach Kevin Wilson at IU, who's a good friend of USA Football's as well. So a little bit of background on USA Football. Dr. Hainline and Dr. McAllister got into a good amount of detail on research. So USA Football is the sport's national governing body. We also are a member of the U.S. Olympic Committee. As an NGB, much like USA Gymnastics, USA Swimming, we do field, manage, and assemble U.S. national teams in the sport. May not be aware, there are about 70 countries on six continents now that have organized football played. There are international competitions through the Sports International Federation. So in addition to that national teamwork, a calling card for us really is coaching education. USA Football now trains more youth and high school coaches combined in football than any organization in our country. And as USA Football has grown, we were created in 2003, our constituency has also grown. And we were born through youth football, but now working a great amount on the high school level as well. As a matter of fact, we are an education partner with the National Federation of State High School Associations, right across town next door to the NCAA. So that's been exciting. So our relationship with Daedalus and Tom and his team goes back to 2012. We were interested to know what injuries are most common in youth football and how frequent are they and what are most common injuries. So, and again, we looked at a number of different potential partners, and although we are in the heart of Indianapolis, Daedalus won it on the merits. And in terms of the analysis and the creative thinking that Tom and his team have put together, they've also worked very hard to get work published, which is most significant to make that data more widely known. So that was back in 2012. And then our signature program, you may have heard of, Tom's mentioned, Heads Up Football, again, began on the youth level. It was initially rolled out in 2013 nationally, piloted it with a couple of youth programs in 2012, and then put it out nationally. I should note, too, USA Football does not run youth football programs. The overwhelming majority of youth football would be that Mayberry, North Carolina Youth Football League. Yeah, that's played within the parameters of that town. They have their own rules, their own standards. So what USA Football does, that's about 80% of youth football. USA Football, among the things that we do, is work with leaders in medicine and sport, like the ACSM here in town, the National Athletic Trainers Association, the American Medical Society for Sports Medicine, and others, in putting forth standards and best practices that youth leagues and now high schools can plug in as their own. So we do not have the ability to mandate the standards that you've seen, you know, Tom put on the board with some impressive rates of efficacy. So a lot of credit goes to these youth leagues, and which is about nearly 70% of all youth leagues in the country now do are enrolled in Heads Up Football, and a little more than 1,100 high schools in the past 2 years since Heads Up Football was made available in the high school level have enrolled in Heads Up Football. So they deserve a good amount of credit. And we can put things forth, but we still need organizations to make that bold step to do that. So, yeah, as Tom mentioned, on the youth level, nearly a 70% injury reduction in youth football. And we just had our study on our first year of high school data collection, all done through Daedalus and athletic trainers at every practice and every game, also showing some really encouraging results. I mean, there's more to be done, but we're encouraged by what we're seeing. One or two, we're talking a lot about concussion, and that is in the news. But Heads Up Football, just by the very nature of the name of it, might make someone think that it's just a tackle technique or it's just regarding concussions. Heads Up Football is a comprehensive way to teach and play the game. Again, rooted in coaching education, the program also addresses through hands-on education as well as an online curriculum. In addition to CDC-approved concussion protocols for recognition and response, sudden cardiac arrest is addressed. And we work with largely Dr. Jonathan Dresner at the University of Washington, who's on our medical advisory committee, in addition to heat and hydration. And we have the benefit of working with Douglas Casa with the Corey Stringer Institute based outside of the University of Connecticut. So those are the three health and safety pillars, in addition to the better tackling and blocking techniques, which the American Academy of Pediatrics also upheld last October in a position statement on youth football, stating the importance of that for players of all ages, and proper equipment fitting, mostly helmets and shoulder pads to optimize player protection through that. And one last thing I want to note, too, we're seeing something pretty exciting. I mentioned USA Football was really rooted in youth football. We've expanded now into the high school space. We're now seeing communities where the youth program and the high schools are both involved, have both enrolled in Heads of Football. So there's this exciting continuum, everything from terminology to how fundamentals are taught. Player safety is up and it's in the forefront. And it's also engaging parents, a parent meeting, and encouraging parents to be at practices and games is a big part of that as well. So we're seeing a lot of changes for the better. There still certainly is more to go. But again, through the work with that Daedalus is doing for us and the work we've commissioned, we've been extremely excited about what we've learned and to know that there's much more to learn and more to go. But we're excited for the game's future and really changing behavior for the better, and that starts in education. Thank you.
Well, thanks. This is kind of the question and answer session now, and I do have some prepared questions, but I think what I'll deviate from the agenda a little bit, and I'll open up questions to the audience first, and then we can go into some of the prepared questions if you don't have any.
I just wanted to shortcut some of your research for you on the golf front. That leads primarily to depression. Seriously, this is powerful presentation. Thank you very much for what you're doing. My question is, our son's a perfect example. He was a collision major, football, hockey, and athletics. I was very interested in your early comments about specialization and the timing of specialization, kind of the lifespan of how you get involved in sports and when you should be at what level of specialization. Could you add to that commentary?
Yeah, sure. I'll make some comments and then open it up to the panel. But, I'm a parent of an 8-year-old as well. And so it's an interesting phenomenon right now, this specialization. I mean, kids are starting at the age. My son at 7 years of age was invited to begin specializing in baseball. And I love the kid, but he's not that good to be playing on an elite travel team. It's more of a predatory behavior by some of these youth organizations, just get warm bodies paying the large registration fees that you have to pay when you're, at least this is my opinion, when you're specializing in a sport. And so, and those organizations want to keep kids in those, playing in that sport and that organization year round because that helps generate revenue for that organization. So I think that's part of the problem and what we're seeing. And I don't have a lot of data in the youth space regarding this yet because it's hard to find funding at the youth level. USA Football has been very generous in that way, and we're going to be able to use some of their data to help inform. But the neat thing about football is still it's not a year-round sport. It's still primarily a fall sport where baseball, soccer, and others, primarily soccer, is year-round, and you got girls throwing softballs year-round, and you're seeing those overuse injuries in those kids. So I firmly believe, and we practice with our own son, that children should play a variety of sports, and there's a body of literature coming out now that shows kids are actually better athletes if they play a variety of sports because they learn how to do all kinds of different body movements if you look at it from a motor control standpoint. So I would encourage playing multiple sports throughout, and I think overall, like Andrew Luck played different sports growing up, and there's lots of anecdotal evidence that from the professional sports ranks where kids didn't start that sport until either later in life or they played a variety of sports. And now the literature's starting to catch up with that, where we're starting to see some literature actually demonstrating that as well. And there's probably less dropout, there's probably less burnout, as Dr. Hainline mentioned. And I'll let others make comments as well.
I'll just quickly note, USA Football strongly endorses playing multiple sports. We encourage kids to do that. One thing to add to Tom is overuse injuries, and the doctors can discuss that. But there is benefit not only athletically to exercise different muscles, but socially, the circle of friends that you have from different sports. You know, I've got a 10-year-old daughter who plays in a number of different sports, and each of them have given her greater, enlarged her circle of friends. So social, emotional, all those benefits to playing multi. And I personally did that and can speak firsthand of how that benefited me. So we certainly encourage playing multiple sports as a youth.
Yeah, so there is an evolving literature on this. The International Olympic Committee came out with a consensus statement. It was about 6 months ago. Mike Bergeron was the lead author, and they put together all the evidence about early specialization. And You know, what's important is this concept of the development of athleticism. And so the IOC fudged a little bit and said, well, maybe you could focus on one sport, but if you're focused on one sport, you have to do it within the context of time off and developing multiple athletic skills. And so ultimately, you're not just playing that one sport. And so the concept is you have to develop what are called the ABCs of athleticism. And so that's agility, balance, coordination, and then speed, stamina, strength. That's the foundation. And when you over-specialize, you actually develop more as a player and less as an athlete. There's another article. It's actually going to be coming out probably within the next 3 months, and it's primarily was put out through the American Orthopedic Society for Sports Medicine, and I'm one of the co-authors on it. And this was the result of a think tank, and we looked at all of the evidence on early specialization. We discussed this in the paper. And, again, it's a very strong statement against early specialization. So, again, early specialization means that you're uniquely playing one sport year-round before the age of puberty. And the data are increasingly strong that that is the wrong thing to do. But I'll tell you how difficult this concept is. So I actually, one of the national governing bodies, in addition to USA Football, that I think has really, really been out in front is USA Hockey. So USA Hockey actually is, they're the governing body who coined the term the American Development Model, and then they allowed the USOC to use it. So USA Hockey came out with a statement that said, 8-year-old kids should not be on the ice more than 3 months a year. There should be no national championships under the age of 12 and no body checking under the age of 12. No sooner did they come out with that than AAU came out and said, well, we think that 8-year-old kids can be on the ice year-round and there should be national championships for 8-and-under kids. So there's this competing forces in our society, and a lot of it is driven by monetary forces. And so AAU is not under the control of the USOC. They're not part of the American Development Model. So they're completely on their own. That's one issue. And the second issue is that coaches need to make a living. And what we don't address in our society, in our American society, is that to be a coach in the United States, all you have to do is hold up a shingle and say, I'm a coach. In Europe, you require hundreds of hours of training both in the classroom and on the field. And it's as rigorous as becoming a teacher in Europe. And so, you know, and there are ministers of sport in Europe, something that, you know, I mean, to talk about adding a minister of sport and put that in the Republican debate and see how far you get today. But, you know, so we don't have any centralized oversight. There's no mandatory coaching education. So coaches are doing what they think are right. Parents are doing what they think are right. But they don't know the data. And so this is a real problem in our country.
We'll go over here and then over there.
How the G's, the accelerations, are measured, if area of impact is factored in, and if medicine has, I know you mentioned the 10G, and you're not sure what that means, but has medicine determined what that level of G's are good or bad?
Yeah, I can. In terms of the technology that we use a what's called a patch or an X patch, and it actually attaches to the skull by the mastoid process behind the ear. And we chose that. There's dozens of different instruments that you could use. Some are actually embedded in the helmets and different things. But this was the most effective way we could get these on the youth kids without modifying helmets, without the increased cost of buying the special helmets with the instrumentation already built into them. And so they worked well for us, and what we were just doing was counting impact. So we weren't getting into the details of the length of impact or the intensity of the impact or that sort of thing. We just wanted counts to see if we could reduce the counts of how many times impacts occurred. And that instrument seemed to work well for us. There's a lot of debate in the instrument world right now about how accurate they are, whether they're in terms of the telemetry, where they're actually hitting on the head and different things like that. So we didn't even get into all that. We just wanted counts, which we think they're pretty good at doing, because we're comparing two groups, assuming the variation of the instrument is equal amongst those two groups. We think we got a pretty accurate estimate of who was getting more hits. Regarding your second question, though, I think Dr. McAllister might be better suited to answer what threshold. I know some of the literature is saying you know, and you have a 75% chance of getting a concussion if the threshold, I think, is above 90 Gs or something like that. But Dr. McAllister, do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, it's a. We started doing some studies of this back about 10 years ago, and we were using a HIT system, which is accelerometers embedded in the football helmets, and ice hockey helmets, actually, men's and women's at the time. And we thought this was going to be really simple. So we were going to put everybody in these sensors. We were going to watch them. When they were diagnosed with a concussion, we'd add up the, so up above a certain number of Gs, you're concussed. And it turns out that that couldn't have been farther from the truth. So we ended up seeing the average G-force for a football team, either at high school or at the college level. I won't address youth because I'm not as familiar with the data, is about 20 Gs. And most of the systems, as Tom mentioned, don't count anything under 10 or 15 Gs. So that gives you some idea. When the football players used to sort of go up and do the sort of bang their heads together in a sort of get pumped up kind of way, that's 15 to 20 Gs, that kind of thing, depending on how big they are. And what it turned out is that that's the average number. At about 60 Gs, you're beginning to get to the 95th percentile of how hard, of the hardest hits. And then, but there's a really long tail that can go up to 100, 110, 120, even 130 Gs. Now I'm talking about, collegiate Division I football teams. And what was really interesting is that there were, certainly there's a relationship that goes, the harder you get hit, the more likely you are to have a concussion. But there is not a threshold. And there are plenty of people who have been diagnosed with a concussion at 60 Gs, and then there are plenty of people who have sustained hits of 100, 110 Gs who are not diagnosed with a concussion, which is not to say that they didn't have a concussion, because we depend on self-report for a lot of these things, nor is it to say that the brain was not affected by that hit, because we don't know, although we hope to get some of that information from the CARE project. And the other thing that I didn't fully appreciate until we actually started looking at this is that it's usually way more difficult to find the so-called smoking gun impact associated with a concussion than we thought. We thought, oh, okay, cool, we'll just either look at video or we'll talk to the player. Well, they're getting, 10, 20 impacts a game half the time, actually a third of the time, the athletes are not reporting concussive symptoms until a day or 2 days later, and there is not an associated smoking gun impact. And then when you peel it down even further, a lot of those impacts are two or three impacts. So they get hit head-to-head, then they lose motor control and hit the ground and hit their head like this, and then their head bounces again, and then somebody knees them in the head as they're trying to. So we don't know whether it's a single impact, whether it's the combination of multiple medium-sized impacts in a very short period of time or whatever. So basic rule applies. The harder you get hit, the more likely you are to have a concussion. But we also did a study in which we said, okay, let's take people who are diagnosed with a concussion. Let's look at how hard and how often they're getting hit on the day that they get that diagnosis and compared it to other games, presumably same intensity. And it turns out that the folks who were diagnosed with a concussion on game day, they were getting hit harder and more frequently than on days when they didn't. Suggesting that it may, again, that it may not just be the single impact, but the context in which that impact occurs. So way more complicated than we thought.
Question, Larry.
Sure, I got a couple of questions. First of all, there's two areas that I would think certainly has G-force and impact that I haven't heard you talk about. One would be boxing and the other one would be automobile racing. So I was curious about those activities. And then the second question is there any collaboration
Great questions. I don't know if anybody's put accelerometer or instruments on race car drivers or boxers. I don't know if you guys heard of anything like that.
Yeah, so boxing is
difficult. I served for many years on the New York State Athletic Commission, which oversees boxing, and was a ringside doc. And but they took me out of the ring because I was always getting nauseated and feeling faint, and would just throw in the white towel. But we are going to have a unique window in looking at boxing as part of care. The four service academies are enrolled, and two of them, Air Force and West Point, have enrolled all of their cadets, and boxing is part of their year-round training. So we haven't moved it to the point of actually putting accelerometers on them during their boxing training, I don't think, but that's an intriguing idea. But at least we're going to have some boxing data. It's very, very difficult. I work closely with Barry Jordan, who oversees the New York State Athletic Commission. It's really tough to track the boxers. It's just a different culture. Race car drivers, I don't know, but one thing very interesting about race car drivers is that NASCAR, it used to be non-collapsible walls, and now it's this progressively collapsing wall, which was designed at University of Alabama, Birmingham. And so that has led to a significant sort of shielding of head impact and body impact. So that's the one thing we know about NASCAR. And actually, then at UAB, there was a football helmet that was designed in a similar way. And it's a really, really cool helmet. But one of the problems is that to get a new helmet out in the market, and then, you know, there's a certification body, and you know, who wants to bring a new helmet out? You know, because you're just setting yourself up, and then the people, you know, and so far there's been kind of a shield against lawsuits with the helmets. But this helmet, you know, it's really very cool, but you'd have to, like, throw it out after a big impact. But with NASCAR, that those forces on the wall has actually radically changed morbidity and mortality in race car driving.
I forget the second part of your question.
Collaboration with...
Oh, yeah. So I know we often share a lot of the data we collect for USA Football with representatives from the NFL, but they're not directly involved or funding the research themselves. They do injury surveillance in the NFL, MLS, MLB, and the NHL. They all have injury surveillance programs through different entities, either within themselves or a company called Quintiles. I know they have an office here. They do some research for Lilly, but they're generally based out of North Carolina. But, you know, being, you know, they're an employer, essentially, of these athletes, and so you got to go through the players' union and all that sort of stuff. And so they've been a little bit more closed circle in terms of, you know, sharing out data and collaborating and that sort of thing. And I think it's primarily because it's an employing organization versus a nonprofit organization like USA Football, which is the goal of educating coaches and different things. So probably not as much collaboration as I'd like to see, but, you know, there might be opportunities there, I think.
Well, the NFL has sponsored 2 years. I don't know if you went to the one in London this year, but there were 2 years in a row the NFL has actually brought together international governing bodies, and it's been a think tank on how to collaborate. And the NCAA has been part of that. So there are very, very active discussions going on, including we have a separate discussion going on with FIFA. FIFA medically is probably by far and away the best medical international organization in the world. Politically, it's a whole other story, but their medical team and their chief medical officer is a neurologist, Jerry Dvorak, who's done incredible work. But so the talks are going on actively. It's just the devil's in the details, really. So.
I think this is first, and then we'll get over to you.
I wanted to ask Dr. McAllister about your Holy Grail comment. And two questions. One, have you decided in your baseline data in your CARE project, have you decided to follow certain biochemical markers, and which are they? And secondly, how close are we to having a quick diagnostic, say, on the playing field, where you take a bodily fluid to be determined which one, and which biomarkers either currently or in the future have potential for this quick diagnosis of brain trauma?
Yeah, we are harvesting blood and serum as baseline, and then in when somebody is diagnosed with a concussion. Again, we draw some additional samples at discrete time points, five time points subsequent to that. So we will have a biorepository, which is located, we do have a biorepository, which is located here at IU, that will store those samples. And so the that plays into your second question, which is we have four or five biomarkers or putative biomarkers that we are going to start by looking at. And we will also be storing these samples so that as new ones become, you know, of interest, we would at some point be able to run the samples again and test the efficacy or the sort of sensitivity and specificity of new biomarkers that may come on. You know, I actually couldn't tell you all five of them at this point, but one of them is GFAP, and I think there's S100 that we're looking at. But bottom line is we're not, in my view, we're not very close at all to having a marker. It's very complicated. The studies that would have to be done, a lot of these markers may be altered by repetitive impacts, just as they are by a concussion. They may also be altered by exertion. They may, the interval from the, when you are going to sample is going to play an enormous part in how sensitive and specific these markers are. So again, what seemed like it was going to be pretty easy has turned out to be way more complicated.
Yeah, I actually just I was in a meeting in Chicago yesterday where Banyan, are we using Banyan?
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And they were providing a presentation on exactly that question: how close are we to? And I think he might have mentioned maybe 5 years out at minimum before we have a sideline instrument that could actually do that, I think. And again, as Dr. McAllister said, I think the science is still trying to catch up with that in terms of what, you know, how, you know, can you actually get the blood and can you get it in there soon enough, and is it affected by exertion or is it affected by the actual injury itself? So we don't know all those questions yet, so those all have to be sorted out hopefully through care over here.
My question was, looking at depression and concussion, you say that most of our concussions clear 2 weeks, you know, but those that linger, when is there a guideline for when you start seeing, like, clinical depression and concussion?
Yeah, that's a great question. So here's what I think it's informed by our knowledge of this complex relationship between brain injury and psychiatric illness in general. And here's what we know. If somebody had a diagnosed psychiatric illness before any brain injury, then they have very high rates of having that psychiatric illness diagnosed in the first year after that injury, even if it wasn't present at the time they had the injury. So in other words, it seems to be an accelerant or a sort of rekindler of issues that people may have had. Interestingly, it may not be the same psychiatric illness that they had before. So it can possibly, if they had anxiety before, they may develop depression in the year or so after. Secondly, and this is true of brain injury in general, not just sport-related concussion. The other interesting point is that if somebody never had any, it doesn't have a history of diagnosed psychiatric illness, the relative risk of having a psychiatric illness, diagnosable psychiatric illness, is in the first year and subsequently even 5 years out after an injury is very elevated. So about half of people who had no psychiatric illness before their injury will have a diagnosable psychiatric illness within the first year or so afterwards. The rates drop slowly over the next 3 or 4 years and eventually get to a point where it's more or less the same as community base rates. With respect to depression, it's tricky because if you do post-concussion checklists, a lot of what is asked on those are mood, irritability, sleep disturbance, lots of fatigue, lots of things which if you then put that instrument down and compare it to instruments which assess for depression, it's mood, irritability, sadness, you know, et cetera. So they overlap a lot. Having the symptoms, as you know, is not the same thing as actually having a major depressive episode. So you'll read a lot of papers which say, yes, depressive scores are way up, after concussion, which is true, but that's because the way we quantify concussive symptoms has a lot of depressive questions in it. I think the best rates that I've seen is that the odds are about, again, if you've never had any psychiatric illness before, you have about a 1 in 2 chance of developing one in the first year after an injury. And of those, far and away, the two most common are depression and anxiety, followed by substance abuse. I'm not sure I answered your question. But, no, okay.
Oh, back here.
So the answer is yes, to the second part of your question. So part of the agreement that we have with the sponsors is that we will deposit our data in the Federal Traumatic Brain Injury Data Repository, FITBR, Brain Injury, whatever it's called, FITBR. And I think Tom's team is about ready to upload the first baseline one. Stuff
on the
31st. It will not be immediately available to people because the laws of FITBR are such that the study has to be closed for 6 months or something like this before it'll be open to the public. So, but the answer is yes, and I also agree that at some point we'll want a more agnostic kind of approach to some of the biomarkers and so forth. For that to be effective, however, you need a much bigger data set of people with biomarkers, same way as GWAS sort of sampling of where you need thousands of people. So we're talking through that and hoping to increase the number of people that we harvest blood and serum on.
All right, I think guys getting the sign to wrap up. So Lori's going to come back up with a few closing remarks. Thank you, everybody. Yeah.
Yes, thank you to our panel. That was fantastic information. And as a former college volleyball player, I was shocked to see the number of how high up they were on the concussion list compared to other. I think the only head injury I recall in 4 years was someone fell in the locker room, so it wasn't even on the court. So, again, thank you guys very much. We'll be interested to see how this conversation continues, and maybe we'll have another follow-up session to see where this has gone. I just want to let you guys know we have another Frameworks coming up another month away. Actually, I think 4 weeks exactly. April 28th, we're going to revisit a report that we did back in August on talent and innovation in Indiana and where that's going. And this report will actually dive into the talent piece a little bit more and kind of look at both the life sciences and healthcare industries to see where there are gaps that are being filled, where are gaps that we need to address and things like that. So it should be a really fascinating session. We've got our folks from Techonomy coming back to talk through that report with some industry and academic leaders to dive into that a little bit more. So thanks so much. We hope to see you guys again in a few weeks.